This is Focus. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. This year, this program, Focus, turns 30, and we are marking the occasion with something that we are calling the Deep Archives Project, bringing back some of the oldest programs we have. These are interviews that have been in storage. They have not been heard in many years. They're not on our web archive. And we've tried to select some topics that are as relevant today as they were when we first broadcast these shows. And the general theme of today's program is media ownership and some of the obligations that go with it. Now, Newton Minow may not be a household name, but you are no doubt familiar with his assessment of commercial television. He delivered it 50 years ago this week. He had been appointed by President John Kennedy to head the Federal Communications Commission, and in his very first speech, he challenged the nation's broadcasters to sit down and watch an entire day of television. He told them if they did so, they would observe a vast wasteland. When Newton Minow talked with our Jack Brighton back in September of 1995, Minow said what he hoped people would remember from that speech was not so much the phrase vast wasteland as the phrase public interest. In a book that he had just published titled Abandoned in the Wasteland, Children, Television, and the First Amendment, he argued that broadcasters had failed to serve the public interest, particularly when it came to programs for children.
Well, in the early days of broadcasting, the broadcasters were extremely responsive. In fact, the broadcasters themselves created a code of the National Association of Broadcasters that was a very sensible code. It restricted the amount of advertising on the radio and later on television. It had standards for children's programs. It had standards of taste. Unfortunately, our own government, the Department of Justice Antitrust Division, went to court in the 70s and knocked the code out on the grounds that it was anti-competitive. This was a foolish thing to do, but our own government did it to the American people.
The early years of broadcasting are very interesting, and you cover a lot of that territory in your book. I want to talk about a little bit about how our commercial system of broadcasting came into being. Of course, it's quite different from the broadcasting systems in some of the other industrial democracies. Why was the commercial system so dominant? Why was there so little effort or maybe little success in developing a more education-oriented broadcasting system?
Well, it's curious. As you travel around the world and look at broadcasting systems, most of the Western democracies in England, in Canada, in France, in Australia, even in Japan, developed systems in which there was either a government operation of broadcasting or publicly financed systems like the BBC in England, where everyone who has a radio or a television set pays a fee which goes to finance a non-commercial service like the BBC or Canada in Japan. We opted a different way. I think our tradition was that the marketplace was the way to deal with things. So we didn't even have a non-commercial service at the beginning, except in a few places. And I think maybe WILL is perhaps an example. There were some Midwestern stations of early university broadcasters, University of Wisconsin, I know, for example, but they were never funded in a way to compete.
Right. Well, and you write about how educators were very concerned at the outset of broadcasting to promote the educational public affairs sort of function that broadcasting could serve.
Unfortunately, those educators were few in number, and were not able to persuade the larger university interests of the importance of broadcasting. In fact, many academics today, tragically, disdain broadcasting, look down on it, instead of realizing it's probably the most important educational institution in our country.
You make the point in your book, and indeed, that television has become the most important educational system, really, in the world.
If I gave our listeners a multiple choice question and said, what is the most important educational institution in America? A, Harvard, B, Yale, C, Princeton, D, the University of Illinois, E, none of the above. I believe the correct answer would be E, none of the above, because more people are learning more from radio and television in our country every day, spending more time with radio and television than they are in school or any activity except perhaps sleeping or working.
Mm-hmm. And it might even come close to that.
In many homes, children spend much more time with television today than they do in school.
Well, let's talk about the impact of that, which you write about. What do we know about the impact of television, particularly on children?
Well, the good side is we know from studies of programs like Sesame Street, for example, that children can learn many constructive things, that later do better in school, and even learn a set of values, which is very important. On the minus side, we learn from more than 3,000 studies that have been conducted over the past 30 years that children exposed to excessive violence on television either become violent themselves or learn to accept violence as a way to solve problems.
And one other point of clarification about the issue of the First Amendment and censorship, and I think you make this point quite well in your book, the TV broadcasting industry has responded very defensively to efforts to limit violent content and other objectionable material on television and sort of reflexively, you know, said, you know, free speech, you can't violate our rights to free speech. But that sort of gets stretched to absurdity when, for example, as you note in your book, a parents' organization proposed a national turn off your TV day, and the response of at least one spokesperson for broadcasting was that, well, you know, by turning off your television sets or by advocating that you do this, you're violating our First Amendment rights to free speech.
Well, the First Amendment has been badly misunderstood. First of all, the First Amendment is a restriction only on the government. It is not a restriction on a broadcaster. It's not a restriction on a publisher. It's not a restriction on an editor. It's a restriction only on the government. In the case, for example, a few years ago when Time Warner was criticized by parents and citizens groups for putting out some of the gangster rap records that advocated violence and beating women and rape, what was Time Warner's answer? Time Warner's answer was, well, we can't interfere with the First Amendment rights of our artists. Well, it had nothing whatever to do with the First Amendment. The First Amendment is a restriction only on the government. It is not a restriction on the chief executive of Time Warner or the president of Time Warner Records or the producer or any of them. That is a matter of responsibility on their part. Otherwise, we've taken the First Amendment and converted it into something it was never intended to be.
So in effect, what the broadcasters are saying is that not only does the First Amendment protect us from making any changes in what we are doing, but it prevents us from even talking about the issues.
Well, I'll give you another example. When I was on the board of CBS, I was concerned about the practice of projecting election returns before the polls closed. And I asked for a discussion of this at a CBS board meeting. CBS News people came in with all their charts and computer projections and databases and exit polls, and they explained how their technology and their knowledge enabled them to know who had won the election before the polls closed. And I said, but why do we do this? And the answer was, well, we have a right to do this under the First Amendment. And I said, that isn't my question. I said, why do we do this? And they said, well, we have a right to do this under the First Amendment. I said, apparently I'm not making my question clearer. I'm not asking, do we have a right to do this? I said, why do we do this? They said, well, we have a right to do this under the First Amendment. And I said, well, you guys are like Pavlov's dog. I said, do we do this for competitive reasons? Are we afraid that if we don't project the election result early that NBC or ABC will beat us to it? They said, oh, no, 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 no. I said, well, why do we do that? They said, well, we know who won the election. We can't sit on that information. We must share it at once with the American people. And I said, well, if that's the case, why do we say we'll give you our projection right after the next commercial? Why don't we do it before the next commercial? I never got an answer to that. I think it would have been, we have a right to do it this way under the First Amendment. People confuse, in Justice Potter Stewart, the Supreme Court's words, people confuse the right to do something with the question of whether it's the right thing to do. And once people say, well, we have a right to do this, that should be the beginning of the discussion, not the end.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we have a couple of the callers, and let's go ahead and talk with them. And next up, line number 4 from Cook's Mill, Illinois. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I'd like to start out just by saying our family has decided the easiest way to take care of the TV is to not have one, and we haven't had one for about 8 years now. We have 2 small children, a 5 and a 2-year-old, and we've not found that they've been deprived at all, especially now she's starting school. We worried about that, but as the 5-year-old is starting school, she doesn't seem to feel deprived or at a loss with the other kids at all. The other comment I wanted to make is a person had called in earlier worrying or talking about the First Amendment and problems with that, and I see a much deeper threat to the First Amendment, and it isn't in trying to control TV programs. It's the fact that the kind of education that people receive over TV and I think it's affected our education system, the biggest threat to the First Amendment is that people don't even know what it is. Our knowledge and information about American history and about our Constitution and laws is so minimal among the average person that's a much greater threat than any kind of control over what might be available on TV. I think we've shifted, and TV, I think, has been a big part of the shift, from educating people to be citizens to educating them to be consumers. And I think we need to get back to educating people to be citizens in our country.
Oddly enough, that is a, I don't know if you've read our book, but that's a line verbatim in our book where we say that what has happened is that television has treated children as consumers rather than as citizens. And I think you're exactly right. If I stopped 100 people on the street and said, is the First Amendment a restriction on editors and publishers as well as the government? Most people wouldn't know the answer.
Mm-hmm.
You're exactly right about that. And most people don't understand the First Amendment. I think what's tragic is that we're debating the evil parts, the sad parts of television, instead of talking about what this enormous gift, this blessing, could contribute to our children. It's the most important invention probably of our century, perhaps, other than the atomic bomb. But instead of looking at it as a way to extend education and help people, we're debating all the negative sides of it. That's what's gone wrong in the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we run out of time, we only have maybe 5 minutes left. I want to make sure to give you a chance to talk about some of your recommendations for, you know, maybe changing the way or spelling out the way we define public interest for broadcasters.
There are a number of things that I think should be done. Number one, we're going to be auctioning off more uses of the spectrum from time to time. And the first thing we should do is go to school on what the Congress did in the time of the Civil War when it passed what's known as the Morrill Act. We started selling public lands, and Senator Morrill, a conservative Republican from Vermont, said, let's take some of that money and create land-grant colleges.
Mm-hmm.
That's how the University of Illinois was started. That's how MIT was started. That's how Cornell was started. As we auction off parts of the spectrum in the next years, where billions and billions of dollars will be coming into the Treasury, we should insist that some of that money go to hook up all the schools and libraries of the country to the information networks, to provide that educational and children's programming be provided, and that ought to be the first order of business, it seems to me, as we think about going into the next century. to bring the Morrill Act into the new world of technology, the principles of the Morrill Act. Second, I think what we should do is reinstate the broadcaster's own code by requiring broadcasters to revive that code and to keep the government out of it. Next, I think what we ought to do is require that there be no commercials of any kind in programs designed for small children. And then, finally, I think the most important thing is to spell out specifically what we mean by the public interest in terms of requiring that service to children be so many hours a day and so on. I'm not dealing with other things in the book that I've written about in the past, such as free political time to take the money, some of the money out of politics, the excessive need for raising funds to attack your opponent. But I'm concentrating here on the issues of children.
Mm-hmm. One other thing I can't resist asking you about, and I hope people will not feel that I'm being self-serving in this, but it has to do with public broadcasting. At a time when, you know, critics from all quarters are essentially saying, you know, commercial television is failing our children, it's giving us too much violence, too much sex, et cetera, et cetera. You know, in fact, some of the people saying that the loudest are also the people in Congress who would like to eliminate federal support for public broadcasting.
Well, it's such an irony that the one place that's doing the best job for children, public broadcasting, is the one that the same people who are criticizing want to stop. I think that public broadcasting is essential. Why do we have public libraries in this country? Why do we have public hospitals? Why do we have public universities? Public broadcasting is in the same category, in my opinion.
Your proposal would increase the educational content. The bill on the back of your book I'm thinking of, or, you know, programs specifically designed for young children. The broadcasters would have to specifically comply with, you know, a certain number of minutes or hours per day.
Right, and what the FCC has proposed is either they do it themselves or they fund other stations in that community to do it, so that at least the program would be available in that community to a parent.
One final question. We only have 1 minute. It's sort of a philosophical question. Television getting a black eye from all quarters these days, and you know, you mentioned that it can do a lot of good things. Do you think that there is an inherent problem with the medium, that in Marshall McLuhan's terms, the medium is the message and television as a message is the problem? Or is the problem what we were doing with the medium of television?
I think the problem is what we're doing with it. Edward R. Murrow put it in one sentence a long time ago. He said, television is either lights and wires in a box, or it's something very important, depending on what use we human beings make of it. He was right.
And that is Newton Minow. He was talking with Jack Brighton on this show. Back then we called it Focus 580, a show that was first broadcast in September of 1995. In the early 60s, he was member of the Federal Communications Commission. He also served as chairman of PBS and as a board member of CBS, and it was 50 years ago this week that in his first speech as FCC chairman, he referred to commercial television as a vast wasteland. In a piece that was published in the Chicago Tribune earlier this week, Minow noted that many changes have taken place in the last half century. He wrote that a television set is no longer just a box in your living room. It's also a phone in your pocket. The wasteland, he wrote, has turned into broadband. Today, Newton Minow is still arguing that broadcasting can do better, that candidates for office should be given free airtime, and that public broadcasting is an institution worth supporting. This year, this program, Focus, turns 30. And we are marking the occasion by re-airing some of the oldest programs we have. These are shows that have been in storage and are not part of our regular web archive. We're calling this the Deep Archives Project. And you can let us know what you think by going to our webpage, which is WILL.illinois.edu, and go to the Focus section. And if you look up at the top, there is a place there where you can leave a comment. And we'd certainly like to have any thoughts you have generally on the program or on this thing that we're doing, bringing back some of these very old shows. We will have more after a short break. This is Focus.
Support comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 2 to 6 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Every week, we're here with 10 different shows. We think of them as 10 different shows, 10 hours of programming, and we cover a lot of territory. And let me just mention that next week, we'll be talking with the authors of three new biographies, important new biographies that have just been published. On Monday in the 10 o'clock hour, pardon me, this is the 11 o'clock hour on Monday, Mary Lovell talks about her new book, The Churchills in Love and War, and indeed is about the Churchill family and not just about Winston, but about all the various Churchills, and they are a pretty interesting bunch. Then Tuesday at 10, the guest is Wendy Wolfe. She is an editor at Viking Penguin and was associated with a new biography that's just come out of Malcolm X. Sadly, the author of the book, Manning Marable, passed away just before the book was published, but Wendy Wolfe had a lot to do with bringing that book about, and she'll talk with us at 10 on Wednesday. And then, that's Tuesday. And on Wednesday at 10 in the first hour, the guest there is Jannie Scott. She's a journalist, and she has written a new biography of Barack Obama's mother. The title of that book is A Singular Woman. So three biographies, a lot of other things coming up next week. You can find out what we have scheduled by going to our website, will.illinois.edu. You can also catch up on some past programs you might have missed first time around. Well, this year, we're celebrating the 30th anniversary of the show. We've been on the air 30 years, and we thought one thing that we might do that would be interesting would be to rebroadcast some of the oldest shows that we have. Now, these are shows that have been in storage, literally have been in storage. They are not on our website, are not part of our web archive, and they have not been heard for many years. And both of the shows today really are about media and media ownership. And in the second part here, we have a conversation with media critic Ben Begdikian. He's the author of a book that is widely considered to be a classic in the communications field, and the book is The Media Monopoly. He first published this book in 1983, and at the time, he outlined his concerns that a small number of companies controlled most of the country's media. At that time, this was 1983, he wrote that some 50 corporations owned most of the output of daily papers and controlled the sales and audience of magazines, broadcasting, music, and movies. When we talked with Ben Begdikian in 1997, that number had shrunk from 50 to about 10. And in that conversation, I asked him how he'd become concerned about this issue of concentration of media ownership.
Well, frankly, I had been working on this book back in the late 70s and the early 80s and just had to get it out of my system. I had worked in the newspaper business most of my adult life and knew, because I worked for a couple of them, that the best newspapers, the best news operations were run by family-owned groups or small groups. Now, some very bad papers were run by family also, but all of the distinguished ones had were run by people who had the power to say, we're making enough profit and we take the news seriously and we will be careful to preserve the special quality that news has in society. And I saw this changing as the news became part of the national, international financial scene and as just another business. And I spent 3 or 4 years working on it, got it published with some difficulty. My former big publisher said they couldn't really handle it. And I figured then, it's out of my system. I'll go back to doing other things. And you're quite right. Some people said it was alarmist, that this is the way it always was, and nothing as much has changed. And then I was almost forced to do subsequent editions because conditions became much worse than I thought they were at the time I did the first edition. So that's quite right. Mm. I was surprised and saddened by how each edition I put out understated the problem.
What do you think are the consequences of this concentration of ownership for the public, for the consumers of news in this country?
Well, I think the public is getting more and more trivial and less central issue news, because so many of the companies that now, the large industrial companies that own the news operations, the major news operations in the country, for example, are traded on Wall Street. Wall Street wants ever-rising earnings every 4 months, quarterly earnings. They're under tremendous pressure to increase the value of their stock, to pay better dividends, even though the newspaper business, for example, daily newspaper business, Standard & Poor's says they make more than 20% profit a year, and broadcasters make even more, commercial broadcasters. But Wall Street always wants more, and so if you're a very large corporation that makes airplanes, electrical generators, so forth and so on, but also owns a news company, a major news company, you see that as a product that has to contribute increasing profits, and what do you do? You shift the news to things which are not going to rock the boat. Local TV news, commercial TV news, for example, is kind of a national disgrace. It's superficial. It's mostly visiting the police station and the emergency rooms every night. Very little coverage of what's going on in the city government and the school system and so forth. So we see the trivialization of news. We see news is mixed with entertainment, and we see news mixed with advertising. And this dilutes and corrupts the news in ways that are subtle and gradually gets a large part of the public used to the fact that news is going to be given by someone with a nice hairdo and a projecting personality, and doesn't make much difference what they talk about. And that leads to a false assumption by much of the public that they know the most important things that are happening that will affect their lives, and they don't.
Mm. Is the concern further than simply that the content of the news is bland, it's not dealing with important issues? Is the concern that that companies who have ownership of newspapers or radio stations or cable networks or whatever, and also are in other businesses as well, will make sure that the journalists who work for them don't do any stories that will reflect negatively on the other businesses in which they're involved?
Oh, that's happening, and it's happening what used to happen subtly in the business, always, which is in papers that didn't have an unusually strong owner that felt that the integrity of the news was important. It was done subtly. If you did a story that showed that the used car dealers in this community had bad record with the regulating agencies, they'd say, well, you know, this really isn't a terribly important story. But now it is wide open. The Los Angeles Times, which may by now be the biggest circulated daily paper in the country of general news, has openly said that there will be co-managers of the news. One will be from the business department and one will be an editor. And that some of the sections of the paper will be run by the business department. And it is the most bold move. I'm sure it'll be followed by other bold moves to adjust the news in order to not make advertisers unhappy and to attract advertising and not to disturb the business community. And I think it's a very ominous development, and I don't think it's going to get better for a while.
We have a couple of callers here. Others who are listening would be welcome to join the conversation.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm afraid that actually David's already asked my question, but I want to sort of press once again for some advice from you as to how to go about locating alternative sources of information. If you don't want to give the 10 best newspapers, I can understand that. But is there anything that you can give me in the way of concrete advice to find a different source of information, whether it's online, whether there are publications that are issued monthly? I want to make a slight comment, and that is that, you know, mainly through this program, have heard different people come on and talk about this very issue. There's somebody who comes on once in a while and talks about the top 10 censored stories that are covered in the alternative media, but not in the big ones that I think you attempt to criticize. And so I go back and I look at those, and I'm kind of thinking, gee, a lot of this sounds anecdotal to me, and I don't know how much of it is substantiated. And so I kind of feel like I can sympathize with your point, and it is disturbing to me that there is this kind of monopoly, that, you know, power seems to be consolidated within the hands of these few corporations. On the other hand, I feel pretty unclear about where I'm to turn in order to find other sources of information. I think you mentioned that it's a pretty difficult kind of thing. I mean, it takes a great deal of analysis and scrutiny. And, you know, for a person like me who doesn't really have that kind of time, frankly, I wonder what your suggestions are is to get a clearer view. Or do you think that a clearer view can really be gotten?
Well, I don't think there's a simple answer to your question, which is, and I understand you want a simple answer because a vague one isn't very practical. I find it useful to look at, and I'm talking now about nationally published material. Locally, one has to judge by one's own, you know, weekly papers and alternative papers, and they vary enormously. Many of them are extremely useful. And so in each city, I would look at those, and some of them are free. And so when you go pick up some of them and look at them and see if they inform you about the things you're most interested in. Nationally, I find it useful to look at the publications that are, in fact, publications of commentary, which then comment if they're, and most of them are useful in the sense that they comment on issues that they care about, and which are frequently issues that you don't see dealt with in any seriousness in the major media. If you're a conservative and you're unhappy, you look at the National Review regularly. If you think that the news that you're getting is too shallow on the center or on the liberal progressive side, look at The Nation, The New Republic, The Progressive in these times. They're very useful in raising issues and events that may strike you in your interests as very important, and begin to give you an idea of where to look for specialized or more concentrated information on those subjects. On the Internet, yes, you can get an enormous amount, but it's chaotic. You have to spend a lot of time searching to find the sites that provide you with the information you want. And I think that requires not only an enormous skill, but a lot of time to find the sites that are giving you what you want. So I find it easier to begin with a printed commentary, including with commentary I don't agree with, to see issues that, in fact, are very important that I hadn't seen much about in the standard media or heard it in the standard media. And that gives you a clue. But I think it takes work, and that's what I regret. That's why I think that the standard news is so terribly important to fight for the integrity of the standard news, because that's what most people are going to get no matter what. And that's what most voters are going to get. But for the individual who is consciously unhappy with what they get, the easiest way is to get these magazines of commentary. Go to a place that has lots of magazines and look at them and see which ones touch your particular interest, because not everybody's interested in the same. Not every issue means the same thing to every person. So that's what I would do. I can't go much beyond that. But if you find a daily paper that gives you some substance, read it every day. Because somewhere in there, sooner or later, you'll see something mentioned, or you may see major things periodically, but not often enough. And then you go to these other sources.
Some of the kinds of acquisitions that have created this concentration that we've talked about happen, there is the opportunity for a review on the basis of antitrust and for questions to be raised about whether we think that kind of ownership across media is a good thing. Have we been lax in has the government been lax in this review and allowing mergers and acquisitions to go forth that in the past we might have said we don't think are in the interest of the American people?
Yes, I think terribly so. I think the Department of Justice has almost put to sleep antitrust actions, which 30, 40 years ago would have been almost automatic, because the measure used then is not the measure used now. And so that I think, yes, antitrust does need to be used, and especially with media corporations, because you're dealing with a what is a social product, not just a manufactured product. And the FCC has reversed its standards also. The FCC used to ask each applicant for a license, what do you plan to do for the communities in your broadcast area if you get this license? And then when renewal time came, and they didn't tell them what to broadcast in the meantime, because they don't and they shouldn't. But after, when the renewal time came up, say, okay, here's what you promised you were going to do for the community. What have you done to complete this? And if anybody in the community thinks that's not really a good reflection of what you've done, we're going to hold a hearing in the community. They used to do that. They have never pulled a license, but it was wonderfully effective in concentrating stations on the fact that they were supposed to do something for their community. The Telecommunications Act of 1996 is emblematic of throwing that all away. They're still supposed to operate in the public interest, but it permits greater concentration. And the FCC has really reversed its position. And now the business of handing out licenses is to make as much money as possible to put into the general funds of the government instead of raising income taxes, or not lowering them. And so, yes, I think antitrust should have been used much more actively, both as a warning that you've got to tell the public why you think public's going to be better served by this acquisition or merger. And I think the FCC needs to get back to its old standards. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do for your market?
Well, there certainly was a time when we had a stronger notion that in exchange for the use of the public airwaves, there was a public service obligation. I'm not sure that that has ever been quite so strong in print media. Perhaps it has been. I guess in broadcasting, there's this notion that the spectrum is finite, and that in theory, anybody could produce a newspaper if you've got the money to have the press. But I wonder whether we also in some way haven't also gotten away from the notion that generally with all media, there is some sort of public service obligation. At least there once was that idea. And that, as you say, now it's simply viewed, the news is viewed as another commodity, and it's a profit-making venture, and that's what's most important.
Yeah, you know, I think now the problem, of course, with print, not problem, that is, the First Amendment is very close to absolute, so you can print almost anything you want, and I think that's a big plus in the long run historically. I think it's a good question whether, you see, we call corporations a person in the law, so the corporations also are covered by the First Amendment in most cases, and I think that's a problem, but that's a matter of court decisions. Broadcasters are supposed to operate in the public interest, and they can be held to it, especially in through-the-air broadcasting. Cable used to be governed by the local community government, but is no longer. And there have been permitted huge agglomerations in the cable business and in the newspaper business, in which, in the case of broadcasting, where government regulation is permitted because it's licensed, that can be implemented if the FCC and the government wishes to do it. And in printing, it takes public pressure to complain, because it's true. Anybody can print anything they want, and you're quite right. In the case of a daily paper, as long as you have a couple of billion dollars to set up a plant and so forth, and not everybody has a couple of billion dollars, so that even though you have the right to scrawl something on a piece of paper and tack it onto a lamppost, that isn't the same power as someone who has the only daily paper in the community.
As you mentioned at the beginning of the program, this issue is something that has concerned you and you've thought about and for a long time, going back at least to the 70s, and that you thought you could get it out of your system by writing the book, and that what you found was that there was the need to continue to update the book because the trend, because it didn't turn around. If anything, it intensified. Given that fact, what can be done about it?
Well, I think that there is a growing counter pressure to the problems we've been talking about. It shows up most markedly in the number of public interest non-commercial groups in Washington and elsewhere that are pushing citizen concerns about the news, whether it is the cultural environment movement or the Center for Media Education or Consumer Federation of America and so forth. There are a number of public citizen by Ralph Nader's group. There is a growing consolidation of people who have a particular interest in preserving their interests in the news and in the public, general public interest. And that's a kind of lobbying pressure, of mobilizing the support of people who are unhappy with the news media, the major media as they exist today. And that's slow and difficult, but it's happening bit by bit. And I think there may be a time in the future, I don't know whether it'll be 2 years, 4 years, 10 years, when there'll be a joining together of such groups, and they will represent a very significant factor in American politics. But that is taking time. When you match that with public cynicism toward the news, which is at an all-time high, then it could result in a change within the next 5 or 10 years. But unfortunately, people are suffering in the meantime from either malnourishment, literally, or just poor information in a democracy. And I think that it requires voter pressure on the government to make the FCC, make the broadcasters toe the line, to complain to newspapers when newspapers clearly are letting advertisers and business intrude into the decisions of the news. And that means taking the initiative. And that's the difficult part. Write letters. They are not ignored. Call and fax the medium you disagree with, and they pay attention to that. They may not have a religious experience that shows up in the product the next day, but they know someone out there is unhappy and is willing to do something. And if you write a letter, let's say to a newspaper or a broadcast station, and you send a copy to the FCC, they realize that this is a small sign of something that could have political significance, that could affect their business, and I think it's useful. But it puts a greater burden on the individual citizen. That's unfair because we're supposed to have agencies that protect that. But the response always has been historically when the agencies fail to do that, the citizens have to act themselves individually and in groups.
And that is Ben Bagdikian. He was a guest on this program. Back then we called it Focus 580. Now we've just dropped off the 580 and it's just Focus. He was with us in November of 1997. Today, he's the Dean Emeritus at the Graduate School of Journalism at University of California at Berkeley. His book has gone now through several editions. It is still in print. It is now titled The New Media Monopoly. When this book was first published, that was 1983, he wrote that he thought probably about 50 companies dominated all of our media. Now, when he and I had this conversation, the one that you've just heard, that was 1997, that number had shrunk from 50 to about 10. And today, most people who look at this issue say that it's probably 5 or 6. This year, we're marking the 30th birthday of this show. As I said, for a long, long time, it was called Focus 580, and now we just call it Focus. We thought one thing that we might do to celebrate, to mark the occasion, would be to re-air some of the oldest programs we have in our web archive, although this really was these programs really have been in storage. They were recorded on cassettes, and they have been packed away in cardboard boxes for a long time. They have not been heard in a long time, and they're not on our regular web archive. And certainly we're interested in what you think about these shows and about this little project, and generally speaking about Focus. We certainly always like to know what you think about the show. Maybe you have some thoughts about programs you'd like us to do. Any and all of that is great. You can let us know what you think about the show by going to our website, That's WILL.illinois.edu, and find the go to AM, then go to the focus section, and what you will find there at the top of the page is a place where you can leave a comment on the show. And of course, if you'd just like to drop us a line by conventional means, you can write us here at WILL. We are at 300 North Goodwin. That's in Urbana. 61801 is the zip code. And of course, anytime you can hear us online, we're at that same way. You can go to that website, WILL.illinois.edu. And if you'd like to know what's going to be happening in the days ahead on this program, you will also find the schedule for next week. All there at our website, WILL, WILL.illinois.edu.